From the Mode Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Pharrell Williams is not happy about a certain song of his being used by a certain president. Then the movie Boy Erased is based on Garrett Conley's experience growing up in a conservative Christian family and enrolling in gay conversion therapy to cure himself from what was seen as a mortal sin.
They gave me an ultimatum. You'll never see us again. You'll never be part of this community. You won't be with God. I mean, what? That doesn't feel like an option.
And we take a rare tour of a movie prop house that hides itself in plain sight in Santa Monica. All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by the Netflix film The Other Side of the Wind. Witness the last film from legendary director Orson Welles, a cinematic event 40 years in the making. The Other Side of the Wind, on Netflix and in select theaters November 2nd.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. There is a long tradition of musicians lending their voices to politicians and political causes. Bruce Springsteen and Jay-Z, for example, were among those who performed on behalf of President Obama. And when Donald Trump was inaugurated, the musical guests included Toby Keith and Lee Greenwood. But what happens when a candidate or elected official's playlist includes artists who don't want their names associated with a person? Earlier this week, Trump played Pharrell Williams' hit song Happy at a future Farmers of America convention in Indianapolis. Lawyers for the singer sent Trump a letter saying, in part, Pharrell has not and will not grant you permission to publicly perform or otherwise broadcast or disseminate any of his music. Many other musicians have objected to Trump's musical selections, but can they really block his using their music? As with so many questions about copyright law, it depends. To sort out some of the legal issues, we talk with Susan Seeger. She's a veteran intellectual property lawyer who teaches at UC Irvine. And I asked her how a politician can play an artist's song without asking them and whether it depends on where it's used.
It totally depends where the song is used. And if it's used in a place that has a lot of public events, like a sports stadium or a convention center, and even restaurants, they buy blanket licenses that they're renewed every year, and the money is sort of divvied up among all the musicians who are members of a musicians organization, and the money is sent out to the musicians afterwards. So it's a blanket license for many, many songs.
So let's talk about some of the legal issues that are involved here. There is something called the right of publicity. I believe that protects the image of the artist, but not necessarily his or her song. What is the right of publicity, and how does that factor into these conversations?
Well, the right of publicity is a very crazy law that is different in every state. There is no federal law. So copyright law is federal, and so it is applied equally in every state. And it basically protects the right of people to stop others from using their name, likeness, or voice for commercial gains.
And then what is the Lanham Act? Because it seems to be somewhat similar, which is the unauthorized use of a trademark. But is that for the band or the artist and not the song?
Well, artists can have trademark rights in their individual names if it's associated with their work and they have a body of work. So, yes, they could sue under the Trademark Act, the Lanham Act. Artists can sue for someone using their name or their songs and claim that it's an implied endorsement, that by Trump playing an artist's song, maybe as a theme song, that implies that that artist supports Trump, and they could sue and claim that violates their trademark rights in their name.
So before we talk about Trump, I want to talk about Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. I want to play a performance of the song I'm Shipping Up to Boston by the band Dropkick Murphys that Walker used at a rally. After he used the song, the band tweeted, at Scott Walker, please stop using our music in any way. We literally hate you. Love, Dropkick Murphys. Not sure that's going to motivate me to go out and vote, but this is the idea of false endorsement, which implies that an artist has supported or endorsed a product or a candidate. Do they have any claim if Governor Walker is using this at a public setting as opposed to a commercial?
Well, I think it hasn't really been decided by a court. I think some artists have made that argument and the cases have settled. So it's unclear, but it's a better argument than a copyright infringement argument. because of the blanket license that are usually issued to public venues.
So now I want to listen to a song that Donald Trump used at a rally just a couple of days ago, oddly the very same day that 11 people were killed in a Pittsburgh synagogue. Because I'm happy. Clap along if you feel like a room without a roof. Because I'm happy. Clap along. So Pharrell Williams, whose song that is, sent Trump a cease and desist letter for using that song at a political rally, and he cited copyright infringement and violation of the Lanham Act. Does he have much of a claim against Trump if Trump had a public performance license?
Well, it looks like, according to the Hollywood Reporter, that they did not obtain a license, that Pharrell Williams, he's part of a different artist organization and did not have any blanket license with that venue. And supposedly the Trump campaign did not get a individual license either. So he may have a claim.
I'm going to ask you about commercials now. In 2010, Charlie Crist was running for Senate in Florida against Marco Rubio, and he used a talking head song by David Byrne called Road to Nowhere in an attack commercial. Byrne sued, and Crist had to issue an apology, which he recorded on video. And in it, you're just going to hear it, but Charlie Crist looks like a hostage in a prison camp reading a letter. Here's what he said.
I do not support, nor do I condone any actions taken by anyone involved in the Senate campaign that were inconsistent with David Byrne's rights.
I suspect that was part of a settlement of a lawsuit. Why is it important to an artist to get that kind of apology? And is that kind of settlement language essential sometimes to people who feel their songs have been misused?
Well, I think for artists who don't want to be associated with a certain Democratic or Republican party or candidate, it's important for the public record to reflect that they were not a part of this, they were not consulted. So I think it's trying to set the record straight that they are not in any way endorsing that candidate.
Why do you think so many politicians are using music right now? What does it give a candidate or an elected official?
I think of like Major League Baseball players who have a song teed up before they bat. You know, each one has their own song, and that's sort of their signature and who they are, and it says something about them. So I think it's another way of imparting a message about who they are and what they stand for. And then music is just super stimulating, and it gets everyone excited.
Susan Seeger is an attorney who teaches media and copyright law at UC Irvine. Susan, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up on The Frame, a look at the discredited gay conversion therapy in the movie Boy Erased. We'll take that ride. I'm feeling okay this morning. And you know.
KPCC podcasts are supported by the Netflix film The Other Side of the Wind. Witness the last film from legendary director Orson Welles, The Other Side of the Wind. The story of a director named J.J. Jake Hannaford, who returns to Hollywood from years of semi-exile in Europe with plans to complete work on his own innovative comeback movie, also entitled The Other Side of the Wind. A cinematic event 40 years in the making. The Other Side of the Wind. On Netflix and in select theaters November 2nd.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. The new movie, Boy Erased, is based on the memoir of the same name by Gerard Conley. Conley grew up in a small town in Arkansas. His father is a fundamentalist Baptist minister, and his family interpreted the Bible to conclude that homosexuality was a mortal sin. So when, after a sexual assault, a fellow college student outed Conley to his parents, the family faced a crisis. They eventually turned to conversion therapy, a widely discredited and in some states outlawed treatment to somehow make gay and lesbian people straight. In the film, a fictionalized version of Conley named Jared Emmons is played by Lucas Hedges. In this scene, he talks with another young man in the program, played by Troy Sivan, who's figured out a way to deal with their often brutal conversion tactics.
Are you okay?
I'm fine. I'm fine.
I'm going to give you some advice. Play the part. Show them it's working. You're getting better.
Russell Crowe and Nicole Kidman play the parents in Boy Erased. Joel Edgerton wrote, directed, and acts in the film. After a screening of Boyo Raised at the Telluride Film Festival, I sat down at an outdoor picnic table with Garrett Conley and Joel Edgerton. Edgerton explained his reaction when he first got Conley's memoir.
I'm notoriously a bad reader. People give me books or scripts and I take a long time to get around to doing it. But little did they know that there was sort of aspects of my early childhood that have turned me into a person who's obsessed with anything to do with institutions. And having sort of vaguely heard about conversion therapy, it's one of those things that sits up there with cults in my mind, prisons. And really what it was my fear of loss of freedom. And I used to pray. I was, you know, that's the other aspect. I was, for a certain window in my life, I was Catholic. And when I prayed to God, it was like that I wouldn't, please God, don't ever send me to prison. Don't ever let me go to war. Don't ever let me get abducted away from my parents. And so reading, getting the chance to read a book and get in on a ground level of that, it was very much just about the institution aspect of it. What I came out of the book with was something very different, and that's what made me want to. It made me get really pregnant with the idea of getting involved with helping in some way to make the movie, whatever way that was. And that was the family story.
Garrett, let's talk about the institution, though, because people who don't know a lot about different faith communities in the United States may not understand the church that you grew up in, Missionary Baptist, and how they saw God, and how they saw God as a vengeful, punishing entity as opposed to a loving and compassionate entity. So how did that upbringing change you as a person? Because I think it's really important to note that you're the person who checked yourself in to this ministry or cult or whatever we're going to call it, not your parents.
Yeah, I mean, there are a few things there that are pretty complicated to even talk about. I mean, Missionary Baptists, they are fire and brimstone. They also believe in a loving God, and it's very confusing. I see the contradictions there, given, you know, hindsight. And it's hard to explain, but they believe in this literal interpretation of the Bible, which is not even possible. If you've actually read the Bible, there are multiple accounts of everything conflicting. But, I think that the tragedy of anyone's life that grows up in that situation in a very fundamentalist household is that you never know what you would have been without that ingrained in you since birth. I mean, I don't know, would I be a better writer? Would I be a more vivacious person? I have no idea. I also just want to add one more thing. It did not feel like a choice. It felt like, you know, I'd just been raped. I was reeling from that. My parents didn't know that, and they gave me an ultimatum. You'll never see us again. You'll never be part of this community. You won't be with God. I mean, what? That doesn't feel like an option.
Garrett, you write in the introduction to your book that, I'm quoting it now, trauma has made dark what was once painfully clear, that it's hard to remember what actually happened. You rely on some materials that were given to you during your gay conversion therapy and what your mother remembers of that. When you start looking at the movie, does that trigger other memories? Is it something that keeps kind of revealing itself and what has suppressed and what you've forgotten and what keeps bubbling up in memory?
I think the emotions come back. Like, pretty much every viewing has brought on some unexpected emotion. Like, I'll always think, oh, I've seen it enough. I'm not going to feel anything. And you know, it'll sneak up on me and make me cry. But, you know, the weird thing about writing a memoir and then having it adapted to screen is that you have no idea what the past is anymore. You're like, these are, you know, this is the general sketch, but it's so many different iterations now. I find myself almost quoting lines from the movie when I'm like talking about my own story, because it's so fresh in my mind.
We're talking with Garrett Conley. He's the author of the memoir, Boy Erased, and Joel Edgerton, who wrote and directed the film based on the memoir. We're talking outside in Telluride, Colorado. Joel, I want to ask you about allyship and what people who may not be LGBTQ can do to tell stories about people who are LGBTQ and how you see yourself as an ally to that community.
I never actively wanted or chose to be an ally, and certainly embarking on this story, I have all my own selfish reasons for doing it. That, as a byproduct of that, I have become an ally I'm supremely proud of. And my first real prominent taste of that, I think, was doing the movie Loving.
We should say that Loving is Jeff Nichols' movie about the Supreme Court case that legalized interracial marriage in the United States.
In the back end of selling that movie, it just was an obvious thing for us to be talking about, knowing that in Australia, marriage equality was still not a thing for the LGBTQ community. And there was obvious parallels there. And Ruth found ourselves, and Jeff Nichols found ourselves being a spokesperson for that. And I was genuinely kind of perplexed and a bit embarrassed about my own country's backward stance on that issue. Now, when it came to this story, I, on a personal level, became so obsessed with Garrett's story after reading the book. And as he'll attest, I asked him if he would write the screenplay. I told Kerry Roberts, look, someone has to make this movie. I'd love to be involved in some way, but maybe from the shadows. And it wasn't until I realized no one else had inquired after the rights. And I could not stop thinking about it on a daily basis. And I was shooting Red Sparrow. I was in a hotel room and I had a 2-week break. And I was like, I'm just going to write a few scenes, just see how I feel about it. And I wrote the scene with the college, Will Henry, the roommate, the assault scene, the coming out to the parents, and another scene from deeper in the end of the movie. And then I just, within a couple of weeks, in a scrambling mess of pouring out, had filled in all the gaps.
Garrett, I want to ask you this last question. There's a title card at the end of the film about the amazing number of states that still allow minors to go into gay conversion therapy, which has been proven to be completely ineffective and a sham. This is a fictionalized version of a true story. What do you hope happens to this film in the larger cultural conversation about LGBTQ rights and marriage equality and everything else tied to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the easiest target at first is ending conversion therapy. It's something that people can get behind, even if they're not totally LGBTQ friendly, they can say that's torture. That's the easy goal. And that's not an easy goal, really. But, it, you know, it's out of all the goals in the culture, that's one of the easier ones. I think on a larger scale, I would love to see this idea of conversion therapy become less of an isolated, how did that happen, crazy moment, and be seen more as a spectrum of bigotry that we have to work with in the country, and connect that to issues like immigration and racism, and show that these are all part of the same thing.
I think you should also mention the podcast, because this is one of the great things about, you know, but the movie's one thing, and it puts a spotlight on Garrett's story, but behind the scenes, Garrett and David Craig, our co-producer, have been working on this other project.
I've been listening.
Plug your podcast.
Yeah, I've been listening to Radiolab for 15 years, and they've done great podcasts. So when we started to pitch this idea of telling the full story of conversion therapy, we got them, and it was so exciting. And they've gone out, you know, across the country to do this great research. They've gathered this group of women called the Mama Bears. They're like these women who are protecting their cubs that are LGBTQ, and they can't always do it in their towns openly because it's very dangerous for them. So they have an online group, and they actually meet up, and they'll travel to pride parades and offer free hugs. And I just think it's like one of the most beautiful things in the world. And so we've got that, and we've got the full history. And I mean, Joel made this possible as well. Focus funded it. Here we are, like, with so many different avenues for opening up this conversation.
Speaking of conversations, are you talking to your dad?
Yeah, so we talk quite frequently. You know, I don't think that he any longer believes that homosexuality is a choice. I think that he knows if he says to his congregation of 150 people, I completely accept my son for who he is, that he'll lose them. Now, do I sometimes wish he would just man up and do it? Yes. And actually, I think it's a bit hypocritical at times, but I don't know why, and I say this at the end of my book, I'm a very stubborn person, and for some reason I continue to love him, and I continue to show up at his church, and I'll do it until I die or and he dies, you know, it's just, we'll see where it goes.
But it is one of the things that resonated me most strongly from the book is, while some people could criticize that, I know there's people who would say, cut them off, if somebody cuts you, you cut them back, eye for an eye, that Garrett is not an eye for an eye person. Always really impressed me, because the longer conversation, the longer arc of the story means that people like Garrett, I think, will always be winning at the end of the day.
Oh, I'm in it to win it.
Oh, no.
Garrett and Joel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Boy Erased is in theaters starting this Friday. The podcast called Unerased premieres the same day. Coming up, we find quirky movie props inside a store that's almost never open.
My fingers danced and swayed in the breeze. The change in the wind took you down to your knees. I got the good side.
If you travel about 25 miles west across town to Main Street in Santa Monica, you'll find a shop that's unlike any other. Two blocks from the ocean, across from a Starbucks and next door to a clothing boutique, it's got a big storefront window with gears, robots, and an intricate model airship. And if you're lucky, it might even be open. Frame contributor Natalie Chunofsky takes us inside Jadis.
If you spend 10 minutes inside Jadis, you'll get used to hearing this.
Well, so I spent about 5 years before I ever walked in, and I always thought it was really quirky and cool, but it was rarely open.
I tell people, not being open all the time increases the demand. You would take me for granted if I were open regular hours.
That's Susan Lieberman, the owner of Jadis in Santa Monica.
The current store is a bit of a museum in that we have things that are pre-computer era with a little descriptive panel. We're a bit of a cabinet of curiosities and a retail store.
Susan opened Jadis in 1976 with her life partner, Park Meek. Park was an obsessive collector. He and Susan amassed so much stuff while antiquing on weekends that they opened a store to sell some of it. And then in the 90s, Jadis also became a movie prop house. So imagine this. It's a Sunday afternoon, and you're lucky enough to find Jadis open. You walk in, and it's like a mad collector's lab. Giant interlocking gears and machines with gauges, quack science devices from the turn of the century. There are wind-up toys, gyroscopes, Newton's cradles, and on the shelves,
these are wonderful science and invention magazines from the 20s. And, you know, in those days, it was happening, you know. There was the car and the airplane and radio and electricity. It was such a heady time of invention.
There's an electrostatic generator from the 1880s called a Wimshurst machine. And if Susan cranks the wheel, you'll see it throw a purple spark. And if you clap or make a loud noise, there's a talking head that will make himself known to you. There is so much to take in that you really just have to focus on what's right in front of you.
These are copper ring towers that iterate Tesla coils. They were used in The Prestige.
That's Christopher Nolan's 2006 movie. And next to the fake Tesla coils,
this piece here actually has a Tesla coil on it. This was probably from the 20s, a piece of medical equipment. So it's a mix in here of rare and then fake.
The fake stuff in Jadis was mostly invented and built by Park himself, like this large boiler machine-looking contraption.
We call it the radio table, I think because there are coils from radios, rheostats, street lamp lighting, and different gauges. Really makes no sense. It's Hollywood. It just has to look great.
Great, but also unique. And that's according to someone who's worked with prop houses for nearly two decades.
My name is Brandy Kalish, and I'm a set decorator for television and film.
Brandy met Susan while working on Teen Wolf in 2015. She said Jadis had stuff she had never seen in another prop shop.
My main mission as a set decorator is to find unique stuff for our set. So when I can find a place that I can get that stuff from, it's really special.
Brandy says that might be why Jadis stayed open, even during some of Hollywood's toughest times.
There was a lull somewhere between 08 and 09 in Los Angeles, and work was scarce. During that time, there were tax incentives in like Detroit, Atlanta, the Carolinas, even Canada, and a lot of work was going out of town.
So it definitely affected the business, and many prop houses had to close.
But the bigger blow for Jadis came in 2010, when Susan's partner, Park Meek, passed away. Susan started thinking about closing down the shop. The LA Times even came to Jadis to write this big farewell article.
Somehow in the course of the interview for the article, we ended up announcing a sale, and people waited at least 4 hours to get in. I just didn't realize that there was the curiosity and that people loved the space. So it was very emotional for me.
She sold a lot that day, but there was still a lot of inventory left over. Susan said she was overwhelmed.
And so I took a break and received a call from a set decorator. He was working on an art film and said that Park's Things would be perfect for it.
That art film was The Artist, which won an Oscar for Best Picture in 2012. And slowly, it got Susan back on track with Jadis.
It was a combination of this fortuitous rental and just the sheer support I got from the community.
At the time, Susan also owned a vintage ladies' boutique next door. But in 2014, she decided to close it down.
And I just had an epiphany one day that I was done with women in clothing, that I just wanted nerds and kids and just to have fun.
And Jadis has survived the ebb and flow of Hollywood, in part because it has all these different revenue streams, but also because people love it, odd hours and all.
Sometimes I have older people come in that recall using these things in their jobs. Then they'll explain it to their kids or grandkids. It's a teaching tool. It's nostalgic. My hope is that it's uplifting, that people are happy when they leave.
For The Frame, I'm Natalie Chinofsky.
And that's The Frame for today. You can find some of our stories on LAIST, that's LAIST.com, and our podcast wherever you like to listen. I'm John Horn. We'll be back on KPCC tomorrow. We'll see you then.